It's 1 John chapter 2, 15 through 17.
Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not in the Father, but in the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever.
Okay. So that's our goal. We want to abide forever. And he makes it very clear, those that do the will of God get that promise. But in order to have the will of God, we've got to avoid the pitfalls of life and the temptations that Satan throws our way. And there he mentions the threefold avenue in which Satan seeks to tempt us: the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And we're going to be discussing these in particular in the coming lessons, but this lesson deals primarily with the lusts of the flesh. All right, so define lust for me. Okay, something that maybe you want.
A strong desire.
An intense craving, I think, would also fit in that definition, right? And as Brother Rogers mentioned in his booklet, it's a neutral term, but when it came to be used in the New Testament, it was almost categorically used in a bad sense, right? An intense craving for that which was unlawful, for that which was evil, that which wasn't accepted by God, things that are contrary to the will of God. Now, flesh, does that mean man's physical body? Okay, I see you shaking head no, right? No, while we understand flesh to be, you know, what's on top of our bones in our body, when we look at that term through the New Testament, it means something deeper, skin deep, right? Deeper than that. And that is the treasure trove, we might say, of our will, of our desire, our inner desires. And that the Bible speaks about having to deny ourselves from these individual desires that we have, a desire for sinful things enjoyed by our flesh. And so he put on the booklet, the source of evil appetites. The source of evil appetites. I think that's a good way to define that. For we know that God had made flesh and blood, flesh and bones in Genesis chapter 2. And we realize that there was no sin. There was no sin. It was when man gave in to his desires, then sin entered the world. And so we have to understand that this is the way in which Satan will seek to work upon the lusts that we have within us, the source of evil appetites. So our essentially our personal desires that we might have. Let's turn to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. And look at verses 14 and 15. James chapter 1, there verse 14. It says, "But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." So here's essentially what this lesson is driving at. Each one being tempted by his own desires. That's the lust of the flesh. And then, when desire is conceived, that is when it's actually taken advantage of what it was wanting, well, then it gives birth to sin, right? It's transgressed God's will. And sin brings forth death, especially in its full maturation stage, when one is overcome by it. And so he says there in verse 16, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren." So we can be deceived by our own selfish aim and desires and temptations to think that we have mastered those and are no longer in need of any kind of
overcoming or watching out or being watchful in any regards. So he says next in the booklet, overcoming the lust of the flesh is especially difficult because these lusts, these cravings or desires are a part of us. They come from within us. Now, on page 23, he has a quote from William Barclay, which was an interesting way to depict man's desires. And I'll read that quote. He says, "The essence of the flesh is this. No army can invade a country from the sea unless it can obtain a bridgehead." Now, does anyone know what a bridgehead is? To be honest, I had to look it up myself. It describes essentially the end of the bridge, the gateway before one enters the enemy's territory, the territory that's desiring to be invaded. That little section at the end of the bridge as it opens up. And so he's saying here that no army can invade the country unless it's obtained that bridgehead. So the avenue in which it can be able to enter with ease. So temptation would be powerless to affect men unless there was something already in man to respond to temptation. Sin could gain no foothold in a man's mind and heart and soul and life unless there was an enemy within the gates who was willing to open the door to sin. The flesh is exactly the bridgehead through which sin invades the human personality. The flesh is like the enemy within the gates who opens the way to the enemy who is pressing in through the gates. And so essentially there's that selfish will, our selfish desire that says, okay, I open up the gates, come on in, come on in. And that's why the Lord says you have to deny self. Take up your cross and follow Him daily. We've got to keep those gates shut. So He says overcoming sin means overcoming the lust of the flesh, which means we must defeat the enemy within. Nancy. Possibly. It's hard for me to remember. but you're right. It's the I. The I that one must be willing to defeat and give over to the Lord, right? To submit unto the Lord and His will. Remember that he who does the will of the Father abides forever. And so it's not about doing our will, our desire. It's about doing the Father's will.
Mm-hmm. And along with this,
right. That's right. And he was successful in overcoming Satan's temptations. And one studies that there's the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life that are all there. Paxton, then Mother.
Well, a couple of things. Something that Christ said in Matthew 26:41 was to watch and pray, entering the temptation of the spirit to be
building
the flesh.
Right.
And another thing I was thinking about was this idea that bridgehead, and you talk about somebody willingly opening up the gate, basically, by the end of the end. You know, in the, what was it, in Isaiah, who was it in the prophets that was talking about the watchman? We just studied that.
Oh, Ezekiel.
Ezekiel talked about the watchman. And the idea of being always on watch and, you know, being the man in the tower who was responsible for everyone. And Christ and the apostles alluded to that same idea that we need to constantly be watchful. You know, Paul said there in Ephesians to be circumspect. And it's not just that you want to be weak, but maybe sometimes people are weak because of apathy or because of carelessness or because they just go to sleep and they, you know, they're not making guard, you know what I'm saying? And so it's not that we just intentionally open the doors they send come in, but if we fall asleep by the door and aren't watching the door, well then the door's open. Anybody can come in, you know, it's the same effect or the same consequence.
Right, and there they were to watch and to pray. Do you have a booklet? Okay, we're in chapter 3. And watch and to pray, and lest you're overcome. And that's what the Lord is warning the apostles there. And so that's a good illustration for us today as well. When we're asleep, when we're supposed to be on watch, we can fall into temptation. Anybody? Oh, mother, sorry.
Because they say Satan, being a spirit, knows our weakness and our desires. Therefore, will tempt us in that direction. However, I once heard a statement said that you cannot prevent a bird flying over your head, but you can prevent him from building a nest. So, in other words, you know, like you said, be on the alert and avoid it. Self-denial.
Right. That's a good illustration. That's right. Every now and then he might touch the top of your head, but don't let them stay there. Don't let them stay there. And that's right. The temptations of life will be there, but we don't have to give in to them. That's right. Good. Anybody else? Good comments, everybody. All right. With that, we go to the next section, the next page. And there we talk about how fleshly lusts war against the soul. Now that's what it says in 1 Peter 2:11. It says, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." And so the command was to abstain, abstinence. Practice abstinence against these fleshly lusts, the very things that we're talking about today. You refrain from them because they war against the soul. And so that quote from Barclay was very fitting as it talks about this enemy trying to invade and it needs to obtain the bridgehead. There's a war going on. And Satan and his workers are seeking to overtake us. It doesn't matter how many years we've been in Christ. It doesn't matter how long our journey has been for the Lord, he still seeks to take us. He doesn't ever give up. So he says next here that sin destroys man's soul and fleshly lusts tempt us to sin. And he quotes now from 2 Peter 2 and verse 18, where he says, "But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. And then when desire is conceived, he gives birth to sin. And sin, when full grown, gives birth to death." Excuse me, that was James 1, 14 and 15. "The flesh within us has lust or desires to sin. It wants to sin. The lust of the flesh has an alluring power." And that's 2 Peter 2:18. Let's look at that verse there. 2 Peter 2 in verse 18. And someone would please read that.
"For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they all allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness. Those that were clean escaped from them who live in
there." Okay, so it has this alluring power, he's saying. And he says that these individuals will speak these great words of emptiness, but they allure. They still allure. It still is effective. And they allure through the lust of the flesh, through lewdness, the ones that have actually escaped from that error. So the alluring power is still there, even though we have escaped from Satan and his snare of the second death. It can still allure us back to it. So we have to watch out for that. Satan appeals to and entices the flesh. He is tempting us to sin. At that point, the battle is on. To give into temptation and satisfy our lust, or to resist. And it's interesting that's really, you know, a binary choice, right? There's only two options: to give in to the craving or to resist it. Now, we're told today in this upcoming election that you don't vote for one, then it's like a vote for the other, right? That's what they say. If you don't vote for one, then it's like a vote for the other. That's that third option. Well, that's not the way it works here with this particular battle. There's only choosing one or choosing the other. Betty.
I have in the margin of my Bible, this is after James, desire plus opportunity equals temptation. Desire plus opportunity plus action equals sin.
Sin. That's good. That's right. That's a true equation. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that idea from verse 18, verse 19 says they promised them liberty, some of these false teachers. While they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption, for whom by a person is overcome, by him also is he brought into bondage. And then you go back there to chapter 1, verse 10, it says, therefore, brethren, be even more diligent to make your call and election sure, for if you do these things, you will never stumble. You know, here Peter, he makes this call for people to grow and to excel and to become what God wants them to, so that they won't stumble, so they won't fall short, so that they can be on the offense and not have to just be defensive all the time, but actually be growing and coming, you know, maturing. But he prepares them with these statements that over in the next whole chapter he's going to talk about all these pitfalls that Satan's going to throw before him with false teaching and everything. And we need to recognize that the lust of the flesh is not just sexual sins or right. drinking or whatever. It can be our attitude towards religious error. It can be our attitude towards the knowledge of God. Just not aspiring to be godly can lead just to just as big a fall as giving into a personal sin of the flesh or ourselves.
Right, like anything against the will of God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very true. And I think it's good that James says that each one is drawn away when he's tempted by his own desires. And so that means that not everybody has the exact same temptation. And so that's why it's a personal battle that we need to seek to fight. The next section deals, though, with some specific sins that are produced by lust. And you'd almost be safe to say that 95% of our world is overtaken by a lot of these sins right here. And that maybe at one time ourselves were. And that we've had to repent of these particular sins. You know, when I first came to the truth, there was things that I agreed with the church I was attending, but there were specific things in regards to my relation with the world that I didn't quite agree with. And when I analyzed why I didn't, it was because I liked those things. I mean, it was really that simple. I liked those things, and so I didn't want to be wrong on those things, you know. Whether I worship with an instrument or not, or whether we send a check to an orphan home or not, you know, that was something that it was more clear to me, okay, that's not what God has asked for. I didn't have necessarily an affection tied to some of those practices. But when it came to these practices of the world, that meant I had to personally deny myself. I had to personally make some changes. And Satan was hoping that I wouldn't choose to make such changes. And so that was my own personal temptations and desires. And so look at this list here, and we're gonna actually take time to read through this, because you hope that everybody's taken time to read it at home, but you never know for sure. And so this is a very important list. We want to make sure that we read through it and understand it. And if anyone has disagreement with it, speak up or forever hold your peace, as the old saying goes. We'll consider it, and we'll look at a verse that maybe you have for us to consider why maybe this is not a sinful practice. But we'll see that there are verses here that uphold what is being said. So the first one is drunkenness and revelries. Romans 13:13.
And 1 Peter 4, 2 through 4. It says, "For some, the pursuit of a particular lust leads to consuming alcohol. Consumption of alcohol leads to drunkenness, drinking parties, fights, regrets, etc. People turn to drugs and alcohol for various reasons, but it is a lust or desire for the high or escape from reality, causing them to continue using drugs and alcohol." So let's look at a couple of these passages real quick, the ones that were quoted there. Romans 13, 13. And when someone is there, if you'd please read that. All right, I'll read it. "Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy." And then verse 14 even makes a step further, saying, "Make no provisions for the flesh to fulfill its lust." And so don't even give it the occasion. Don't go to that store. You know, whatever it is, if you've got that particular desire, you stay away from that place. And 1 Peter 4, 2 through 4, we read and we expanded upon last week. But there's some other verses there in 1 Peter I'd like us to just take a quick glance at. In 1 Peter chapter 1, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, it says this. It says, "Therefore, gird up the loins of your mind and be sober." It demands soberness or sobriety. In chapter 5, in verse 8, there it says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Again, in order to fight against that lion, we've got to be sober. We've got to be individuals that are free of intoxicants in our mind. Chapter 4, verse 7, it says the same word, "But the end of all things is at hand, therefore be sober," or serious, "and watchful in your prayers." It's the same word in the Greek, means sober. So three times he mentions that in this book. And then in chapter 4, he even expounds in verse 3 that we don't walk in drunkenness, revelries, and drinking parties. And so he really emphasizes this. And that word for sober, it literally means in the Greek, being free of intoxicants. They're just not to be found within our bodies. We free ourselves from them because it can become a lust that wants to be fed continually. God's wise in telling us to refrain from it. Of course, Proverbs 23, 29 through 32, other verses that emphasize the need to refrain from alcohol. So anyone want to argue the point or agree or disagree? What? Everyone on the same page? All right. Very good. Very good. Some will argue it from other passages such as John 2, Jesus turning water into wine. And you can see from 2 verse 6 that had to be unfermented grape juice. Otherwise, he made 180 gallons of alcohol, which of course is more than any bartender would serve in a night. It would be ridiculous to claim that the Son of God would do that. And there's other verses too that sometimes are used to uphold it, but there are answers to all of those. Drunkenness and revelries, he says very clearly, stay away from the drink. Okay, number two, fornication. "For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God." That's 1 Thessalonians 4, 3 through 5. Pursuing the passion of lust will result in fornication. There are some obvious things that excite the lusts for sexual sins. And so the list goes on from there to mention things that fall into that category. Things that excite the lust for sexual sins. All right? Fornication, of course, is having sexual relations outside of marriage. Now, God wants us to refrain from that. And he tells us also to pursue holiness. And so in so doing, that's going to mean we're going to refrain from things that are on the fringe that would excite the passions of lust that would lead one into fornication. And so the first one he mentions is dancing. It says, dancing by its nature, that is, by the very inherent forces within it, supplies an effective avenue through which individuals are tempted to pursue sexual sins. I mean, that really makes sense when you think about it, right? You got a man and a woman holding each other, hand on the hip, hand on the back, or embraced, and moving together, right? Yeah, there's music involved, but if the music was turned off and the movements were the same, you get the idea. It's a situation of foreplay, right? Leading up to that fornication where the flesh then gratifies its passions. It doesn't take a scientist, right? A rocket scientist to put those two together. So he goes on to say, oh, go ahead.
You don't actually have to be embraced for that to take place because some people's body movements just are so suggestive.
Right. Very good. Very good. That's right. It can just be right in front of you and you can view it and it's going to cause the same stimulation. Yes, Pax.
You go down here to the middle school to the talent show and watch all that. Like Mom said about the kids, I'm never going to go to another talent show in middle school or high school because they got all those kids from there. Cheerleading squads and the dance groups and, you know, singles and doubles, they'll have four or five of them out there and they don't meet the dress code for the school and then they get out there and
kick the legs up. Yep.
Absolutely. And it looks like a brothel when they get done.
Yeah.
And it's pretty dangerous.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. Very dangerous. So here's the reason why. He says some verses in the New Testament closely connect the words lewdness or lasciviousness and lust. So there's the passages, Romans 13:13 again. And it says, lewdness is translated from the Greek word eslegia, which means wanton acts or manners, as filthy words, indecent bodily movements, unchaste handling of males and females. It's a perfect description of the modern popular dancing. Sometimes individuals say, I want to see the word dancing in the Bible where God says I'm against it. Well, what God does is draw a picture that He's against. And this picture includes dancing, but also where there's filthy words or you know, half-buzzed individuals. And so it draws this scene of just the passions running wild, doing their own desires. And he describes it there, indecent bodily movements, unchaste handling of males and females. Now he says, dancing excites the flesh and invites sexual sin. While some Christians try to deny this, those in the world willingly admit it. Isn't that something how he wrote those words? While some Christians deny this. It's a tragedy. But it goes to show how powerful the world's influence is, even on those that are members of the Lord's church, to sway them to the point where they would deny that reality. But he says, the world recognizes this reality. And he quotes from an author that wrote about dancing, and he has the reference there, The World History of the Dance. And here's what this author said. He says, the whole range of modern dances are designed to express love making. Let me read that again. The whole range of modern dances are designed to express love making. I also looked up some other things online as well. A man named George Shaw, he was made popular by coining this expression that dancing is the vertical expression of a horizontal desire. The vertical expression of a horizontal desire. So the world recognizes that these things are intertwined with the practice of dancing. Why would Christians deny that recognition? Shouldn't. So he says, those in the dancing and medical profession state that dancing is a means of stimulating sexual impulses. I mean, there's the show Dancing with the Stars, right? That hopefully no Christian watches. But if you're flipping through the channel and you see some advertisement for it, it doesn't, again, take a rocket scientist to see how those things do that. And then how individuals in that show have been on the news for having committed
adultery against their spouses because of their particular mate that they were paired with on that show.
Steve.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Steve.
Go ahead.
They say more babies are conceived out of wedlock on prom night than any other time.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this point next. He says, much of what passes for dancing today is simply a gateway to intercourse. Why do high school dances have to be chaperoned? Why do young people reserve hotel rooms on prom night? The stimulation felt on the dance floor is no different from the stimulation felt in the bedroom. I mean, there's a reason why they dim the lights when there's dancing, right? No one dances in the bright lighted areas. And so it is. It's a leaning towards that fulfillment of the sexual impulses. Now, let's look at a few passages. Let's look at Job 21. Job 21. Job, of course, we know was an innocent man that was suffering. He couldn't figure out why he was suffering. And his friends were telling him, well, there's some kind of wickedness in your life, some kind of sin. And Job says, no, that's not the case. That's not the case. And he says, I look at the life of the wicked. I see the practice of the wicked, and that does not mirror my life. So he describes the life of the wicked and the things that they indulge themselves in. And Job 21, he says, verse 4, as for me, my complaint is my complaint against man. If it were, why should I be impatient? Right? He's saying, I'm trying to figure this out from God's point of view. Why is this taking place? Verse 7, why do the wicked live and become old? Yes, become mighty in power. Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, neither is the rod of God upon them. Their bulls breed without failure, their cows calve without miscarriage. So he's saying that there's all these benefits that seem to take place to them, these things that are going on in their life. And he goes on to say in verse 11, he says, they send forth their little ones like a flock, and their children dance. They sing with the tambourine and harp and rejoice to the sound of the flute. They spend their days in wealth and in a moment go down to the grave. Yet they say to God, depart from us, for we do not desire the knowledge of your ways. And so he describes essentially this frivolous life that is given to self-service. And in the end, they just do not love God. They don't want to serve God. Depart from us, God. And one thing he described of them is he says, their children dance. So they bring up their children in this, they train their children in this way, and then of course it leads to, as we've been discussing, to the fulfillment of sexual passions later on down the line. These are sexually immoral individuals, the wicked of the world. So the question we have to ask us is, are we like the world? Are we going to say, no, we're going to stand against that practice? Our children may not have the capacity at this level of age, 6, 7, or to understand sexual passion, but we know that one day they will. And so we're going to refrain them from such a practice because that's the way of the world. That's the way the wicked go. And we don't want our kids one day saying, depart from us, God. We don't love you. We don't want to know you. So we're going to shelter them, guard them from that particular practice. And so that's why it's important. That's why we start every school year talking to the teachers. Hey, there's certain things we're not going to have them involved. If there's PE type dance, you know, just send them to the library. You know, we don't want them to ever feel comfortable with moving and shaking and throwing their body around in a compromising type way so that one day Satan has the bridgeway, you see? And is able to open up the door into their heart and allow these other practices where they then will have those lusts and desires and seek to fulfill them. We've got to be wiser than the world. We've got to stand against the way in which it seeks to indoctrinate our children. Questions, comments, disagreements? You sure? All right. I wish we just had more folks here today. And there's more that need to hear these lessons as well, and it's so important to overcoming sin. Okay. All right. I wrote down a couple of illustrations, like the PE type dances. They were popularizing this daddy-daughter type dance. And again, it's not like a dad's going to have these passions over his daughter, even though with pedophilia nowadays, you kind of wonder sometimes. But the idea, again, it's just breaking down the barriers to allow something that will be dangerous for the child down the line. Cheerleading as well is on the list. There's so many other aspects in which Satan seeks to just bring us into these things, these practices of the world. We've got to stand against them and guard our children. We want them to go to heaven more than anything in this life. And that's one way in which they'll seek to break down those barriers in school apart from us and our overwatch over them. Okay, let's go to the next one, unless anyone has a comment. Okay. Next one is pornography. Isn't it interesting? All this in the same list: fornication, dancing, pornography. It says certainly it supplies an avenue of temptations for individuals to pursue sexual sins. Pornography is not an innocent fantasy or a victimless crime. Jesus says the man who looks upon a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. The whole purpose for pornography is for a man to look and lust. Looking upon naked bodies, either in person or in pictures or videos, excites the flesh and invites sexual sin. And then he uses 2 Samuel 11:2-4, which is the time when David saw Bathsheba, right, taking a bath. And then he decided to invite her into his home, and he lay with her. Now, the verse he used before is Matthew 5:28, which is, if anyone looks upon a woman to lust for her, has already committed adultery with her in his heart. That would be satisfied, no doubt, in pornography, but even like the point before, in dancing, right? Where they're right before you and they see that also can be a temptation to lust for her and commit adultery within your heart. See, these points interconnect. Pornography is addictive. The sight of naked bodies sends a rush throughout the viewer's body. He wants to enjoy again and again. The sinful images will be burned upon his mind and will poison his heart. Matthew 5:8. Like Job, we need to make a covenant with our eyes not to look upon a woman to lust after her. I'll never forget going to one of the truth lectures, and they did one of the lessons on pornography, and the lecturer asked, just for a show of hands, of how many they know in their congregations that are personally struggling with this particular sin. And it was amazing to see the sea of hands. I mean, we cannot overlook how dangerous this sin is, that promises a fulfillment of one's desire under the guise of secrecy. And you can't be seen, and no one will know, and none of the brethren will find out, and everything's... And it's taking place. But the thing is that eventually it comes out. Eventually it boils to the surface. Or it could be that eventually one is so overcome by it, and they know that they've failed so many times, that they ask for the help of the brethren. And so they need some extra hand-holding and help. But it is addictive, as he describes here. And it has a domino effect of destruction upon one's life and one's marriage and one's family. And so we can't just wink at this and say, oh yeah, pornography, that's of course that's wrong. It is wrong, and it is ensnaring souls today, sadly, even in the Lord's church. It says pornography can also destroy one's marriage. While viewing pornography does not satisfy the exemption granted by Jesus in Matthew 19:9, that is to divorce their spouse for fornication, because fornication is a physical act. It says, wives who have discovered their husband's viewing pornography feel as if their husbands have been cheated on them. The violation of trust and feelings of inadequacy, such as, why am I not enough for my husband, caused by pornography often create a great hurdle in the marriage relationship. And so it is a tragedy, it's sad, and it's eaten up, sadly, brethren, today. We are nearly out of time. Any comments or or questions. I didn't think we would actually get done with this lesson. I actually thought it probably should have been broken down into two lessons at least. So we're just going to do that ourselves, and we'll pick up here, Lord willing, next week. No, with this one, we're going to pick up here. We're going to finish this off, and so we'll definitely get to modest dress and mixed swimming and homosexuality, and then how to overcome. This book is about how to overcome, right? We overcome by confronting and not ignoring and making the changes in our lives that need to be made. Thank you, everybody.